Chris Wiggins also has a poster titled Ab Initio Prediction of Transcription Factor Binding sort of stuff. But my ab initio is very different from Chris's. So this is so you should see the poster also. So in the middle of this slide is, so I was introduced to a new word today actually by Chris, a radiculogram, just showing a mess of, so this is actually work in preparation on a human protein interaction network, but it's, I guess, also called a hairball. And so it's like a Rorschach test to see, you know, what you look at. So my collaborators in biology see this thing, or at least that's what they want to see, is this thing over here. But like if you read, you know, some people see a power law. This is, I think, you know, this, if you ever have a chance to see Barabasi and John Doyle talk together, please, you should. The motifs, other things, you know, maybe see. What you really like is the databases, the Paul idea. But what I'm going to be talking about in this first part of the talk is actually sort of trying to focus in at molecular detail, atomic level detail, on what some of these edges are. And even though this hairball is protein-protein interactions, what this is a transcription factor bound to a piece of DNA. And this, so the research plan that I want to talk to you about is what happens when you get a new genome. So you pick a new organism to sequence, you sequence it, and so you can see the genome sequence in the genome browser. And then it's pretty easy to use a set of hidden Markov models like PFAM to pull out all the transcription factors. And then the next thing that maybe you'd like to know is what genes each transcription factor regulates. And there are experiments going on where you do like a chip-chip experiment or a protein hybridized to a double-stranded DNA chip, or you look at expression data, and for each transcription factor, you have some data about what gene it binds to, or gene it regulates, and then from the promoter regions that you think it binds to, you try to estimate a motif, so a DNA sequence that a transcription factor binds to, and from that you build a gene regulatory network. So that's the experimental way. What I'm going to talk about is to try to do this prediction directly, just from the protein sequence of the transcription factor. So we're going to take a transcription factor, look at its protein sequence, and just from the protein sequence of the transcription factor, tell you where it binds. There's been related work, sort of the same goal, on a particular class of zinc of transcription factors called zinc fingers, where you look at the protein primary sequence. And with a recognition code, it's almost like a base pairing rule about what nucleotide, an amino acid side chain, will bind to if it's in a certain position on the zinc finger. There's been some mixed success using empirical potentials with three-dimensional modeling, but what I'll talk about is really doing a full calculation for the free energy of a transcription factor DNA complex, and then cycling through different possible DNA sequences that a transcription factor could be bound to, to figure out the sequence it binds to. Now, after we do this, we still have the challenge when we figure out the motif that a transcription factor binds, then we want to find genes where this motif is upstream. So that's sort of the second half of what we do with this information. All right. So the reason why this is feasible is because there are conserved readout mechanisms. The transcription factors come in families, and family members all share a binding mode. So this is a picture of homeodomain transcription factors bound to a DNA major groove. This is a PDB crystal structure that was deposited by Cynthia Wolberger, showing yeast mating factor alpha 2 with two of these transcription factors bound to a piece of DNA. And then, so that's the one, that's this ribbon in red. So here's the DNA, and then this red chain is the mating factor. And then there's an alpha helix in the protein that binds to the major groove of the DNA. And then superimposed are crystal structures for, I think, ultra bithorax, Drosophila transcription factor, and PDX1, a human transcription factor in the same family, showing that they all bind with the same mode. But they're all different protein sequences, so they bind to different pieces, different DNA sequences, but their three-dimensional structure is very similar. And then this is a picture of an AP2 protein in plants that binds to the DNA major groove using a beta sheet to bind to the DNA major groove. Most transcription factors use an alpha helix, not a beta sheet. And if so, but
okay.
We hope. Yep. What they have in common is that way back there was an ancestral transcription factor, sort of the first ever homing of the main transcription factor, which might not have even been a transcription factor, maybe it was a DNA binding protein that that all of these proteins trace their lineage back to. So this is sort of divergent evolution. The protein sequences have diverged, but the three-dimensional structure has not diverged. The function in general, I mean, the function is, they all function as DNA binding proteins that are specific transcription factors, but they just recognize different DNA sequences now. So here's a picture of how that happens. So these are members of the AP2 family that haven't diverged so long ago from each other. These are different members of the AP2 family in Arabidopsis. And here are protein sequences for four family members. And you see in gray are positions that are conserved either perfectly or sort of somewhat conserved among the family members. And then in color are the variable positions, and it's the variable positions that determine the DNA binding specificity of each of these proteins. And so it's sort of a fixed scaffold, and then by changing a few of these amino acid side chains, they recognize a different DNA sequence. And also, it turns out that there are only a couple different scaffolds in use, or at least a small number of scaffolds contains maybe 80 to 90% of the known transcription factors. The scaffolds are important, depend on the kingdom of life. For human vertebrates, zinc fingers are important for plants, and actually it turns out malaria, this AP2 family is important, and then homeodomains, helix loops, other families are seen in different types of organisms. And so now what's the status of picking one of these transcription factors and determining where it binds? So I mentioned that there's been work in recognition codes, but this has really been limited primarily to just the zinc finger family. It's an important family. It has a lot of transcription factors in it, but it's just one of the protein, one of the transcription factor families. There's been some work with implicit solvent models. And what this means is you do a simulation of DNA and of the transcription factor, but you sort of immerse it in a sort of a continuum with a dielectric continuum close to the dielectric constant of water. And the problem with doing it, the problem with doing it that way is that some of the interactions between the protein and the DNA that give specificity have a water molecule in between that's sort of hydrogen bonded to the protein and hydrogen bonded to the DNA. And if you don't have explicit water molecules in your model, you just really end up not getting that right. And so if you want to predict where a transcription factor will bind, you really need to have explicit water, unless you're lucky and you pick a transcription factor that somehow doesn't have water in the binding interface. It turns out that if you're working on a design problem, that instead of predicting where a transcription factor binds, you want to design a transcription factor to bind a certain sequence. Then not having, you can sort of design it not to have water in the interface. And so for design, the implicit solvent models work okay, but for prediction, they don't. And so what we're doing is a full-out calculation of DNA and transcription factor bound in water. So this shows sort of the readout mechanism for a transcription factor bound to DNA, that when the base pairs in DNA are bound to each other, on the major groove and also on the minor groove, there are hydrogen bonding opportunities to proteins that can sort of stick in. And normally these are satisfied by water molecules when the transcription factor isn't bound, or maybe possibly by side chains of a histone. But when a DNA binding protein comes in, it sort of reads out the hydrogen bonding pattern in the major groove, and different base pairs have different hydrogen bonding patterns to read out. Okay, so if you're on the sort of the standard way of explaining where a transcription factor binds is a motif like this. And so what this means is that, you know, this transcription factor likes to bind to a DNA sequence that has an A and a C and an A and a T. So this is reading on one chain of DNA. The other chain of DNA would be a T and then a G and then a T and then an A. The way these pictures are generated is you start with a multiple sequence alignment of different pieces of DNA that you think your transcription factor binds. and then you sort of tabulate for each position how often you see each base, and then to make a visual. So going from here to here, you've lost information because you've lost pair correlations between positions. But nevertheless, this is a common way of displaying the information.
And you also don't include information about the affinity of the binding.
That's right. So you don't, So we've discretized the affinity of the binding to be 0 and 1. Yeah. All right. And then the visual summary, the height of each letter is the information content. So if all four base pairs are equally likely, the height is 0. If there's one base pair that shows up all the time, the height approaches 2 bits of information. And then the relative height of each letter at one of these positions is proportional to its probability. And so I should cite Berkeley Web logo that we use to make our pictures. All right, so that's from the position weight matrix side. And what we're doing is we're calculating the probability the probability, given a sequence, the probability that that the transcription factor is bound to the sequence divided by the probability of unbound given the sequence is proportional to e to the minus delta, e to the minus delta g over kt. And what this delta g is, it's the free energy of the transcription factor DNA complex minus the free energies of the separated components. And so if we want to calculate the relative probability, so if the transcription factor is bound, given that it's bound to DNA, the probability that it's bound to DNA sequence 1 divided by the probability that it's bound to DNA sequence 2, that's equal to the Boltzmann factor of the differences in these binding free energies. And so if we write out what that is, it's the difference of the binding energy, the difference of the energy of the free energy of the two transcription factor DNA complexes, and then minus the difference of the free energies of the two DNA sequences in water. There's this piece that's the salvation energy of the transcription factor alone that cancels in the calculation. So what we're looking at is we have transcription factor bound to DNA, and we calculate the free energy change for changing DNA from sequence 2 to sequence 1. And then we have just the DNA in water, and we calculate the free energy change for changing sequence 2 to sequence 1. And from that, we calculate delta G. And so we can do this for pairs of sequences. If we take an additive approximation, which isn't really correct, but this is the approximation that was used to get the position weight matrix anyway. If we take an additive approximation that these delta G's are additive over positions, or that the probability of bound is multiplicative over positions, then we are able to convert delta G's that we measure using simulations to a position weight matrix. So just for a visual summary.
Do you assume a rigid model of binding?
No. So the implicit solvent models often have taken a rigid model, but no, we don't. So what that means is, so we need a starting point the protein folding problem has not been solved. So if someone gives you the primary sequence of a protein, you don't know its three-dimensional shape. So you need to start this calculation by giving your protein a three-dimensional shape. So one thing that you can do is look to see whether somebody's crystallized your protein, and if they have, in the protein database, you can download the coordinates of each atom in the protein, at least in its crystal structure, all right? Now, you can do a simulation where you keep all those atoms fixed. And often people do that, and you can either keep the main chain fixed, and in these calculations that other people have done, often you keep the main chain fixed, but you let the side chains sort of fluctuate according to some probability distribution that you think is reasonable. But in our simulations, everything is allowed to move. So the DNA backbone moves, the protein backbone moves, and the protein side chains move, and the water molecules move. We even have counterlines that move. All right. So now what we do is, so now if you think about a single position in the DNA sequence that transcription factor is bound to, there are four possible nucleotides of that position. So there are, in theory, six pairwise combinations that we want to calculate. But since we're calculating a state function, really there are only three energy gaps. So with three measurements, we can figure out the entire information about how, which base pair is favored at a given position. so we do three simulations to calculate these three energy gaps. We do three calculations for the transcription factor protein complex, and I'm sorry, transcription factor DNA complex, and three calculations also just for the DNA. And so we go from this to a sequence logo. The way that we do these calculations now, sort of in more detail, is we take a transcription factor that we're interested in, we make a homology model of the transcription factor, dock it to DNA, and then to make sure everything's equilibrated, we run for at least a nanosecond, maybe more, of the transcription factor DNA complex. And then at each position, we do sort of a comparison of G versus C at that position, and a comparison of A versus T at that position. And then we do the same thing for the DNA alone in water. And then we figure out the winner of this competition and the winner of this competition. And then we do a calculation of the winners versus the winners. And that from that we generate, yeah.
So I've actually read that the transcription factor needs to be one of the known scaffolds, so that you have a structure of scaffolds.
Yes, so that limits us to like 80 to 90% of the annotated transcription factors. Yeah.
So in this docking, do you allow deformation of the DNA?
In the actual docking, we use just docking. I mean, actually, so the docking really is not docking. And so if you hear about docking, usually people are talking about protein-protein docking, where you don't actually know the binding mode of one protein to another protein. This is sort of the easiest possible case, where not only do we have homology, not only do we have crystal structures for the different transcription factor families, but for each of them, we have also a crystal structure or an NMR structure of one of those family members bound to DNA. So we know the, you know, docking is basically we erase the old side chains and we put in the new side chains.
In the same way that you have a
Some of these transcription factors bend DNA. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the DNA would start out being bent the way it is in the crystal structure, but then hopefully in this one nanosecond equilibration, when we let everything be flexible, that the deformation will relax to whatever the value should be at equilibrium, we hope.
Is there a reason why you just don't do one homology model with just the transcription factor complex with the DNA versus do the transcription factor first and then do the docking after? Couldn't you just do one homology model with the complex?
Yeah, actually, we really just do one with the, yeah, we really just do one. So now the way that we actually do these calculations is we have a Hamiltonian for the system where we have, so we introduce a switching parameter that, so lambda sub alpha is either an A or a T or a C or a G on one strand and then sort of the paired base pair on the other strand. And in this, so a lambda where one of the components is one and the others are zero is really like a pure state or a really physical state that you could actually have in DNA. And then if two of these components are a half, then that's like a 50-50 mixture of two different base pairs, or we have like an equal mixture of all four base pairs. And then the way that you calculate a free energy difference between two different states is you do an integral from zero, well, so here I'm saying, you know, parameterize lambda. So maybe when x equals zero, lambda is 1, 0, 0, 0. And when x equals one, lambda is 0, 1, 0, 0. So x goes from 0, 0 to 1, maybe switches us from having an AT to a TA. And so we do this integral from 0 to 1 of the derivative of, you know, we average the value of the derivative of the Hamiltonian at that lambda state. So standard thermodynamic, standard free energy perturbation. And from this, we can get the free energy change that we're interested in. What we're doing for now is we're using a linear approximation, which means that we do, which is equivalent to doing a single point calculation at lambda equals a half. So if you, so this linear approximation, if you have a model where you have an effective linear model where that, so here x means the solvent modes, where the solvent modes couple linearly to the DNA state, that you find out that. This half point calculation exactly gives you the right answer. So you can work that out. And also for many sorts of solvation problems, it seems that effective linear models do a reasonably good job, even when you wouldn't expect them to do a good job.
Quick question, linear means linear in what?
So here what linear means...
The Hamiltonian is
yeah,
linear
so here linear means two things. So first of all, so what this... So imagine, say, that... So here X stands for a solvent mode. But to be simple, you could just think about X as a... And actually, X could be sort of a vector of solvent modes, and this prime means vector transpose. But if it's... So X is a solvent mode, and then XA is sort of its equilibrium position in state A. And so it's a quadratic form in for each state that you're in, it's a quadratic form with a coupling constant K between different solvent modes.
That's a matrix, right?
Yeah, so K is a matrix here. Yeah.
You
would do effective linearization. So where you could get it from, in principle, if you wanted to figure out what it was, is you would pick a state A and do a simulation in state A and figure out the, look at the energy fluctuations in state A, and then by looking at, you know, doing, say, a Fourier transform of the energy of the time correlation, of the time autocorrelation of the interaction energy between the solvent and this thing you're studying, you would get the spectrum of linear modes. So it's that sort of thing. Not that we're going to do that. In fact, we tried to do that. It didn't really work out so well. We tried to do that in a pure state, and it doesn't work out so well. But in mixed states, I think that would work out reasonably well. But anyway, so basically, if you have a quadratic form like this, and this coupling matrix K doesn't depend on the state you're in, then that's what makes it a linear model. So those are the constraints of the model. I'll actually show you results that show that we're not in the linear region.
But you're saying if you were in that approximation,
yeah,
you'd be exact.
Yeah. Sometimes it's interesting to know, you know, under what circumstances is my approximation going to be exact? So it's efficient to have a linear model, but it's not necessary. It still seems to work okay without a linear model. So here's a graphical view that we have, say, two states. Here's AT base pair, here's a CG base pair. And we calculate the average energy. We calculate the average energy, the average value of Hamiltonian A as a function of this parameter lambda. And when, say, lambda equals minus one, we have an AT base pair. And when lambda is plus one, we have a CG base pair. And in the middle, we sort of have a 50-50 superposition of the two. And what we want to get is this difference between the minima of the two parabolas. And it turns out that if you look at the difference between the parabola's heights at the zero point, it ends up being the same because they're both parabolas. So here are the first results that we got. This is for yeast mating factor alpha 2, and we started with this one because the person who crystallized this protein, Cynthia Wahlberger, is at Johns Hopkins, so it was easy to talk with her and figure out that we were doing something reasonable. All right. So the way that we organize the calculations, as I said, looks like a single elimination tournament. So here are five positions, I guess these positions, and at each position we compete first TA against AT and CG against GC, and then we take the winner of each competition and compete them against each other, and then we get a final winner. But we also have the energy differences that we calculate for the winner versus the loser. These are in kcals per mole, and our error bars are about a half kcal per mole. And so this is the ab initio prediction that we get. And then this is, if you look in TransFAC, where it says that this protein binds, this MAT alpha 2 protein. And so the good news is that if you look in TransFAC, there are only three high information content positions. And each of the high information content positions we get right. So it looks like we're getting the high information content predictions right. But then we also make some strong predictions that end up not showing up in TransFAC. So for instance, these two T's that we predict are part of the binding motif don't show up in TransFAC at all. And we were puzzled about this for a while, but then So it turns out that there are different sources of information for where a transcription factor binds. And a lot of people who do this sort of stuff have sort of said that TransFAC isn't maybe the best place to look for your motif. And we won't go back to the paper that our collaborator published on what the binding site of this protein is. She experimentally verified genes who seem to be under the control of this MAT-alpha-2 protein. And for these genes, actually, this TT looks like it's part of the binding motif. So different people use different sets of promoters to say what the binding site is. There's another difference in that the Cynthia Wolberger paper looked at the binding of alpha-2, this alpha-2 protein, in a heterotetramer with MCM21, whereas the TransFAC data is for an A1 alpha-2 heterodimer. So transcription factors often bind sort of combinatorially with other proteins. And something else that could be happening is that either the sort of this multi-transcription factor complex is changing the binding specificity of one of the components, or it could be that sort of, if you know, that when A1 binds, it sort of pulls alpha-2 to sites that don't have this TT. So we're not really sure what the answer is yet, but at least it seems like this part of the prediction that we're making is not necessarily wrong. Could be right. It's not useful as a gold standard. Well, I mean, it's not that it's not useful as a gold standard. I mean, I think from...
Like, if I predicted something and it wasn't a TransFAC, I don't know that I would use that
to see. It seems like Jasper people trust more than TransFAC in terms of the entries there being high quality. But I think... the point is, I guess, if you're really interested in whether you match, it's good to go back to the literature and see where the data from TransFAC came from. All right.
I didn't quite, maybe you said, did you have counter ions?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not actually sure whether you really need the counter ions, because, I mean, it's an Ewald sum type calculation, and so you should be able to do it in a uniform neutralizing background. But the lore seems to be that it's better to have the counter ions there.
Well, there's some experiments where they show divalent ions do different things in monovalent ions. I don't know if it affects this type of system.
Well, I mean, so there's some proteins, some transcription factor proteins that have an ion as part of the protein structure, like a zinc finger. We're not looking yet at transcription factors that have an ion. But even those that have an ion, the ion is to maintain the protein structure. It's not to bridge the protein-DNA interaction. So I don't think that the counter ions are really necessary in the sense that you want them. You could wonder whether we would get better results by not having the counter ions there, because probably the sampling of the counter ion sort of motions in the solvent is not really that fast. And I think it's just voodoo I make fun of biology friends sometimes, because they have these protocols that they just follow blindly. And, you know, you ask them why there's something in this protocol, and they say, well, you know, it's because that's the protocol I got, and, you know, who knows. And so I think that's sort of the status of counter ions in these sorts of simulations. It's sort of voodoo that when people started doing them, they had them. But I think probably a uniform neutralizing background would be fine. And I mean, if you think about the implicit solvent models that people use, that essentially is a uniform neutralizing background. So, yeah.
Should you do any sort of significance testing on your predictions? I mean, if you had to predict one letter, certainly you had a quarter chance of it. You had like three letters. Where is your p-value? Or something like that.
All right, so let's look at this. I mean, so the p-value of our prediction. So we have a 1/4 chance of being right at each position that we calculate in, so what's the probability of getting this good by chance? So it's a quarter times a quarter times a quarter times a quarter times a quarter.
I mean, it wouldn't really be that simple because you have.
We don't get. Yeah, it wouldn't be that simple, but I mean, you know, if
I'm
you.
I'm just asking
yeah.
if you ever.
We're not that.
Consider this as a validation of the, you know, the strength of your predictions. A little bit more. Seeing, I mean, because you're predicting a fairly small box. If you were, you know, predicting 100 base pairs.
Well, but the transcription factor is only bind
right,
to.
I mean, it would seem likely that you know it's not just a random chance. But I'm just curious if you ever did any significance testing on your predictions.
Well, we'll do it right now. So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, I mean, it's really, so this A, I'm not sure what's going on here, but I guess, you know, if you want to call it a strong prediction, we would include it. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So what's the probability of matching 1, 2, 3, 4, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so 5 out of 7 by chance. So combination of 7 things 2 at a time, times 1/4 to the 5th times 3/4 squared.
I'm not asking you to
No, but we just
do a combination right now. We can do it later. I'm just curious if you have to assign penalty for getting wrong letters.
No, but that's what we did. 3/4 the probability of getting the wrong one.
I can't say I followed exactly
yeah.
what you're suggesting.
Yeah, I think another slightly different question. When you make decisions about
So I don't have, there's some feedback and I don't want a microphone. Here are the energy differences in this example. So 1 kcal per mole, 2 kcals per mole.
So
I mean, it depends on the position and the, so if you see something like this, here's our prediction, where there are two base pairs that are very, you know, sort of low, sort of same height, that means the energy gap is pretty small, like a half a kcal, something like that. And the error bars in our simulation are like a half a kcal, I would say.
So the large size emitters refer to about 1 kcal per mole.
Well, once the energy gap between the best position and the next best position gets much bigger than 1 or 2 kcals per mole, you end up saturating at the lowest energy state. Well, I can't answer that because we've just been using, I don't know what force field we've been using. We start out doing these calculations using AMBER, the AMBER force field, and then AMBER can't do the perturbations that we want to do, so we switched to using CHARM as a simulation engine, but I don't know that we've switched from the AMBER potential to the CHARM potential, or the running charm with the AMBER potential. So that's sort of embarrassing.
Quite small differences, actually, and we're talking about electrostatics.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this method better be stable to the force field that we use. I just, you know, we're either using standard AMBER or standard charm. All right, so now also one thing that we can do is we can, So we're calculating these free energy differences. We can actually partition the free energy difference into the part that's due to interactions between the solutes, so the DNA molecule, and the rest of the system, and also the changes that are due to internal energy in the DNA. So we're partitioning energy, sort of the contribution into everything, and then everything minus, say, DNA deformation, DNA self-energy. And we see that at some positions, the two predicted nucleotides differ. And so what that means is that there's a contribution to the binding specificity due to DNA deformation. And we pick this position to take a look at what happens as a function of this lambda parameter that takes us between two different base pairs. And this is, So what we're doing really in these calculations is that we're taking sort of the area under this curve from 0 to 1, and so So no. So what we're doing to make our calculations is we're using this single point calculation at lambda equals 0.5. And then we're taking the difference between this and this and the difference between this and this and then some we're taking the difference between this and this and subtracting it to get the full delta G. And then to look at just the solvent-solute contributions, we again sort of do the same thing where this is these are the delta G's for just the solute-solvent interactions, and take the fixed point 0.5 minus 0.5 calculation, and then get this value. And if we really had linearity, then as a function of lambda, we would have a straight line here and a straight line here and a straight line here and a straight line here. And the slopes might be different, but they'd be straight lines. And what's going on when we actually look at our system is that it's linear sort of for a small region where we sort of have a big contribution from each nucleotide. But then when we get close to the endpoints, so here like AT and then on this side TA, then it goes away from linearity. But it may be possibly what's saving us to get what looks like the right answer is that the non-linearities maybe cancel here and here. And also it looks like there's some inversion symmetry around this 0.5, and having inversion symmetry would also end up giving us a good value from the half point calculation. So now this is the next one that we were starting to look at, or that we started to look at, is GCN4, which is a leucine zipper protein that binds as two monomers that interact with each other and then bind to DNA. And in our simulations, we started by just looking at a half site for one of the two monomers bound. And here's a picture of the part of the leucine zipper that we're including in the calculation. So here it's sort of side, and then here on the end, seeing it. Yeah. Yeah, we're not treating that at all. We're assuming the histone is not there. I mean, there's evidence that when transcription factors bind to DNA, the part of DNA that they bind to is the part that's not really wrapped tightly by a histone. But I think that's really, we're not dealing with this larger length scale dynamics of DNA unbinding from the histone. And I mean, you might also argue that really the comparison that we should be making is DNA with transcription factor versus DNA with histone. So we're not trying to do that either. All right, and so now here are the results for this one. So TransFact says that this protein binds to a motif that has TGAC. So in our simulations so far, we're getting the T and the A and the C, but not the G. And possibly one thing that's going on is that we haven't calibrated the system as long. So we're seeing whether with a longer simulation that we start to get this position right, I'm not sure. The reason why TransFact has strong predictions here is because it's actually a TransFact entry, not for the GCN4 half site, but for the GCN4 dimer. And so the other molecule in this dimer is the one that's responsible for this specificity. So we're not going to get this part right doing a simulation of a monomer. And so one thing that now we're starting to look at, or that we're able to look at, is so for positions that we see that the solvent term is important, actually for all the sequences, we're starting to look to see whether it's important or whether waters are able to go in and out of the interface. So the whole point of doing this calculation with explicit water is that we're hoping that we're able to get these important water molecules that bridge the transcription factor into DNA. So we have to check that water can diffuse in and out of the interface in a time scale that's fast on the length of our simulation times. And so what we're looking at is for a particular a particular amino acid side chain and a DNA base, whether there's a water molecule that forms a hydrogen bond that bridges the transcription factor in the DNA, and if there is, what the identity of the water molecule is. So for part of the simulation, it looks like this water molecule is in the interface. And then for the rest of the simulation of 100 picoseconds, another water molecule sort of jumps in. And so the lifetime of a water molecule in this interface seems to be about 20 picoseconds. But this is really just looking at one sort of one position. We're going through the simulations now to try to figure out what the lifetime is. And so the idea is that if this lifetime is on the order of 10 or 20 picoseconds, then we're doing a good job sampling waters in the interface, and we're probably going to be able to make good predictions. If this lifetime ends up being longer than our simulation time, then we'll probably not make good predictions, because possibly there's supposed to be bridging water and it doesn't get in or out. We'd have to think about what we would do to equilibrate that faster. So here's, so now, how long do these simulations take? It turns out, sort of on a wall clock day, it takes us about 20 days to do one of these calculations. Actually, most of the time, say 15 of those days, is spent equilibrating the DNA protein complex to get a good equilibrated starting structure. So this is sort of the issue of relaxing the DNA and the protein backbones. That ends up taking a long time because we have to do this as one long serial run. But then when it comes to looking at each position, we can do each of the positions in parallel. And so the rest of the calculation after we have an equilibrated structure only takes 3 or 4 days. And so far we've been doing these calculations one position at a time, holding the other DNA positions fixed. Possibly we can make these two base hybrids at each of the 10 positions instead of just at one position, and maybe get a tenfold speed up. We tried actually doing, so we're just doing two base superpositions. We looked at doing four base superpositions, which you might think would speed up the calculation. But if you do the four base simulation, you have to sort of reweight the data points with a Boltzmann factor that has to do with differences in energies between the different states. And those Boltzmann factors end up giving low efficiency for that sort of sampling. So it turns out for here, we think that the two base sort of superposition is better than the four base superposition. So here are the plans. So these pictures are from the from TransFact, not from our calculations yet. So here's the Mt. Alpha 2, other homeo domains that we're looking at, and then the leucine zipper. All right. So that's the first part of the talk. Yeah.
Can you compare directly with free energy measured in experiments? Right. It seems like you're taking free energies, converting them to this, and the experiments also.
So I think there's some calorimetry data that gets measured. The issue is calorimetry measurements are, I think, usually reported as free the difference in salvation energy between protein DNA and then, yeah, free and bound. And actually, that's part of the calculation that we're skipping because we're canceling that. So you'd have to do a calculation. Possibly if you have a free energy model, say for DNA, say transcription factor binding to different DNA double-stranded sequences, and some sort of competition experiment, then that's the sort of data that we could compare directly to. Another issue is that these transcription factors also have general affinity for DNA. So if it's an experiment that sort of directly measures the affinity, the sort of the binding free energy of DNA to a transcription factor, or that's sort of that's a systematic thing that we're just not including. I guess it's sort of the same answer as the first answer. All right. Yeah?
Trying to identify the consensus sequence on the DNA.
Uh-huh.
Are there opposite type of studies, you know, for
that is a design problem where you wanna, where someone gives you a DNA sequence and they want you to give you a transcription factor that binds to it.
So
and
the same type of arguments we call.
Well, I mean, for that actually, the general thinking now seems to be you design a zinc finger. And there are even companies that do this, I think Sangamo is one of them, that have proprietary algorithms that go from a DNA sequence to a zinc finger. And it's important for synthetic biology projects if you want to design some sort of, actually Druendi is going to be here at the end of the week. And I mean, that's what he does when he wants to get, you know, he has a, you know, it's, so that's, so for that inverse problem maybe, or the design problem as opposed to prediction, basically it's semi-solved that you would use a zinc finger and use recognition rules for zinc fingers if you want to do that. So now, my remaining 9 minutes, I'm going to talk about two quick projects quickly. So this is it's the Hebrew edition of Blade Runner. So I'm working on a project on synthetic biology, and I think Blade Runner is probably the best popular culture example of synthetic biology. So it was originally set in 1992 in the second edition, Philip Dick moved it up to 2021. The movie was 2019 for some reason. And this graph shows why it might be feasible to synthesize human genome, like a new human genome. So this is the time axis, and this is sequencing and synthesis throughput. And then this curve is Moore's law. So DNA sequencing and synthesis is going up faster than Moore's law. And this highest point here is, so also you can see by 2010, I mean, if things go the way they are, we'll be through the roof in DNA sequencing and DNA synthesis. So this highest point is something that I helped invent, and it was published in Nature in, I think, last year, and you can actually buy one of these machines, but I don't get any royalties. All right, so the project is to use this throughput to redesign yeast. And so here's the idea, is we want to make yeast version 2.0, where this is, here's a blow up of part of yeast. And if you look at the yeast genome, there are some regions where there are no genes, so maybe you don't need that part of the yeast genome. Yeast has things like repeats that are like transposons or viral elements that have gotten into the DNA. Maybe you don't need those. Yeast has pseudogenes, so genes that look like they're not really, things that look like they're non-coding, maybe we can get rid of those. There are also genes, so here in bright green are genes that it seems that even though yeast has the gene, if you pamper the yeast cell and grow it in mice media, it doesn't need that gene, so you can knock out that gene without having a growth defect. So maybe we can target some of these genes for deletion. And so that's what we're trying to do, is to resynthesize yeast chromosome by chromosome.
Why do you want to knock out abnormal species?
Because we don't know what they do. So we're going to knock them out, and then if the yeast cell lives, we figure out they're not important. So we don't, I mean, so one way to figure out what, so there are a couple, so actually, so this is just one of, so here are some nice things you can do if you resynthesize yeast. Say you want to put in unnatural amino acids. Right now, the way people do that is they take out one of the stop codons from the ends of the open reading frame, and then you free up one codon for reuse. But instead, you know, maybe what you want to do is free up more codons when you resynthesize, change the coding sequence for an amino acid to avoid some more codons, then you free up more space for natural amino acids. Or maybe you want to put in some tags to make it easier to do genetic experiments on yeast. So put in some extra recombination sites. Or maybe you want to do some rezoning of yeast chromosomes. So yeast has lots of tRNAs scattered all around. So instead of having all the tRNAs scattered all around, you can put them all into one place and sort of manage them a little better. Also, yeast has some introns, and people aren't still sure, you know, what would happen if you took out all the introns from yeast? Are they really needed? So I think, you know, part of it makes a better reagent for doing biology, part of it answers some interesting questions, and part of it, I think, is just, you know, to do it because at this point it looks like it's feasible to do. And Science, actually, last week's issue, had a paper on something similar to this, making a minimal E. coli and looking at its properties.
So
yeah.
What do you mean DNA synthesis? Yeah, but every peptide, they did single deletions and diploid,
So the issue, the issue is just the efficiency of homologous recombination. And you want to minimize the numbers of homologous recombination you do by making these chunks that you put in bigger and bigger. Also, homologous recombination, in the end, we want to replace all the sequence, and if you have lots of overlapping tiles. So yeah, we're doing homologous recombination, but we're just doing it with 30K to 90K chunks, tiling it across. And it's just because so you would want to use homologous recombination.
I don't have a question. You're confused. When you say you free up space, you don't really mean that.
Oh, so what I mean is we free up, so say that you want to put an unnatural amino acid into a protein, sort of in an in vivo system. The standard way that people do that is, I guess, they recode any UAG stop codon as a UAA or the other way. And then you freed up one of the stop codons to have, so you can engineer a tRNA that is ligated to an unnatural amino acid that recognizes this codon that's now, used to be a stop codon, but now isn't used as a stop codon anymore. So that's one possible codon you can use for unnatural amino acids.
Can you just insert it? Why do you need to delete something first?
Oh, because there are only 64 possible codons. And a lot of them are already used for amino acids. In fact, all but, I guess, two of them are used for amino acids.
I'm aware of that, but I guess I'm told.
If you want to insert an unnatural amino acid, you need to have a codon that's not coding for an amino acid now, right? Now, in the normal organism, all of the codons that are possible because of redundancy end up being used. Some are used more frequently than others, but they all end up being used. So what you could do is look at a codon that's not used much, and every time that codon appears in a protein coding sequence, change it to a different codon that's more common for that amino acid. And now you have a codon that's no longer being used for anything, and then you can use that for an additional unnatural amino acid. So that explain that? We're also putting in tags to some more stuff, how we're predicting what genes are most likely to be dispensable. Now for how I actually got involved with the project. So here's the issue, is that this whole genome is being redesigned, and there are different people working on it, and so people want to check out parts of the chromosome and say, I'm going to work on this part, and then person B says, I'm going to work on this part, and then they have to make sure that they don't check out the same part, and they want to put their changes back, they want to make sure they don't collide, or maybe we want to have two different design paths. And then it could be that we have to, that when we put in these changes, it kills the yeast, and we have to go back up the trunk of the development tree. And so it's just like software development, where you have a source development tree. So those pictures are actually from Subversion, a book on source code control. So we're using standard soft source code control to manage different people working on different parts of the genome. And so if biologists knew how to use command line, we'd be completely fine. Actually, we wouldn't be completely fine because of the granularity of check-in, check-out. But what we're doing is we're putting this underneath the front end of the genome browser that Winkenstein wrote for model organism work. So it does all this underneath. So that's the plan.
Have you started this yet?
Yeah.
So they start knocking out regions?
Yeah, left part of chromosome 3 and the entire right arm of chromosome 9.
And it's still viable?
Part of chromosome 3 is in, it's still viable. Chromosome 9, we're just doing the design now. So we haven't got chromosome 9 back. Oh, also, so we're not actually, so what we're doing isn't actually knocking out the genes that we think are not essential. There's this Cre-lox system where you can put in a DNA sequence, say, flanking something that you think isn't important. And then when you express this protein, a special protein, in the presence of these two DNA sequences, it causes the DNA to recombine, and you sort of spit out a small circular piece of DNA, and then you have the rest of the chromosome there. And so what we're doing is we're picking genes or regions that we think are non-essential and flanking the regions with these sites. And then we're going to do an evolutionary experiment where we grow the yeast with all of these non-essential, possibly non-essential regions flanked. And hopefully, you know, if it kicks out something that ends up being essential, it's going to die. And we're going to let evolution explore this combinatorial space and see what ends up being kicked out. Because what you can kick out ends up being path-dependent. They're genes that aren't themselves essential, but if you knock out, like, gene A, then gene B becomes essential. So if we knock out gene A first, then we'll end up having to keep gene B, and if we knock out gene B first, we'll end up keeping gene A. But then there are much also higher order dependencies, and we don't know what those are, and so we're going to let the yeast cell at least explore some of them for us. So that's the idea but we want to pick the genes that we think are most likely to survive, you know, mm-hmm. the organisms most likely to survive their deletion. Pick those for flanking. All right. Now, in the remaining 3 minutes, I talked to Chris about a little bit, which is the power law, so the power law picture of networks. So there have been lots of data sets published now on protein-protein interactions, some of them actually in the same species. And if you look at what people are doing with this data to say figure out how many total protein-protein interactions are, it's a Venn diagram method where you look at the interactions that you saw on screen one and the interactions that you saw on screen two and look at the overlap region, and then from a 2x2 contingency table, you try to figure out how many total edges there are in your protein interaction network. And so we want to do better than this. I have pretty pictures here showing somebody fishing for protein interactions. And I guess, given that there are only 1 or 2 minutes left, it's not quite worth it, is it?
Just give us a conclusion.
I could give you the conclusion. All right. Let me tell you what we're able to predict, all right? And then if you want to ask me how, I'll talk about that. So here's the issue. You're doing a yeast 2 hybrid screen, and if you don't know what that is, I guess you have to ask me afterwards. But it costs a certain amount of money to do the screen. And from doing this screen, you get some true protein-protein interactions, so protein interactions that are really true, and you also get some false positives. And the question that maybe you want the answer to is if you now spend twice as much money, how many more true positives are you going to get, and how many more false positives are you going to get? So we're able to predict that, we think. So I would call this sort of the analog of the Lander-Waterman model for genome sequencing, where the idea is if you sequence so many more pieces of DNA, say from a shotgun approach, what greater fraction of DNA are you going to cover, and how do things assemble? So we're doing the same thing, but for a pairwise screen for protein interactions. And and we're doing this for data, published data sets for yeast and for worm, also for fly. This black curve shows as you increase the amount of work that you do, the black line is the observed number of interactions that you get out of your screen. And then the dashed line is sort of the experimental data. The black line is our theoretical fit that is pretty much just on top of the observed line. And then what you don't get from the experiment, but we're able to predict, is the fraction of true positives in that data and the fraction of false positives. From this yeast data set, you know, we would say that it really looks like we're still getting more good interactions out of this data, and it'd be worthwhile to spend more money and do more two hybrid screens. This is a worm. This is the worm data set that Mark Vidal's group published. And so from this green line, that's the true positives, it looks like it's sort of saturating. So, you know, we would tell them, no, you probably don't want to continue doing more work. Probably what you want to do maybe is generate a new prey library. One of the differences between the worm screen and the yeast screen is one of the possible differences is that this worm screen used full-length ORFs. And maybe if instead of using full-length ORFs, you focused on domains, you'd get more interactions out of it. So we're able to predict, if you spend more money, how many more interactions you get, and how many are good and how many are bad. We think we're able to predict the total number of interaction partners for a protein. So here on this axis is the number of observed interaction partners, which we're modeling as a mixture of true positives and false positives. And then on this axis, we plot our predicted number. So the number of true positives that were observed plus the number of false negatives that weren't observed. And so for some proteins, we predict that the observed count is really too high, and a lot of these observations are false positives. And then for others, we predict that, you know, they really have more interaction partners than have been reported. And then we can also do things like look for power law distributions for the degree. Here, actually, what I'm just plotting is the cumulative probability for the node degree. And if it was a power law, you'd see a straight line. Curving like this shows that decay is probably faster than a power law. And what I was talking with Chris about was model selection. So we can also use what we're doing for model selection, say, to choose between different one-parameter models for degree distribution, say, the Erdos Ringi network model or a power law model. What we're seeing is that the power law is clearly superior to an Erdos Ringi model. Sort of a minor point of contention is that light sampling of an Erdos Ringi network can give you a network that looks like a power law. But what our model does explicitly is correct for light sampling, and we show that even after correcting for light sampling, clearly it's much more like a power law than an Erdos Ringi network. So that's a one-parameter model. There are different two-parameter models that you can look at, and there are heuristics that let you decide between whether adding the extra parameter helps you, and then three parameter models, and so on. And that's it. All right. So I want to thank my Angela Liu did the transcription factor binding site prediction. Sarah Richardson and Pingyi in my group did the synthetic yeast work. And Jeff Buka is really the person driving the project on the biology side. Hylan Wang of my group, and then a collaborator on this last thing that I talked about. Thank you.